quick message from our sponsor, Bump Social. Bump Social is a new revolutionary social media app that is coming out on iOS and Android with new tools and features and functionality for users, brands, creators, influencers, the whole gamut, to really take the social experience to a whole new level. So make sure to check them out in our description down below. Again, they'll be out very soon on iOS and Android, so stay tuned. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Blockhash Podcast, episode 391. Today, I have a expert federal prison consultant, Sam Mangle, here on the show to talk about some of the people that he's consulted with, comments on individuals like Sam Bankman-Fried, for example, within the Web3 space, and what he kind of does for a living, helping people navigate this part of reality for them. So Sam, welcome to the show. This is going to be a very fascinating episode, and I have a lot of questions for you. So thank you for taking the time to come on today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And one of the reasons, or the main reason I'm an expert, is I've been through it. So everything that we're going to discuss and my points of view are not theoretical. They're actually practical, having experienced nearly every facet of the federal prison experience, from being remanded to custody and detention center, similar to where Sam Bankman-Fried was, right down to the transport and winding up at the camp in Miami for about 21 months. So I hope I can answer your questions and provide some insight.
Let's do it. But before we do, tell me a little bit more about yourself. I'm sure people will be curious, you know, what's your story? How did you kind of end up in this line of work? And, you know, what brings meaning to it for you?
2016, I had already retired down to Florida. I had two great children, a 31-year-old son, a 28-year-old daughter, just married 35 years. So 2016, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm in my office at home, and I hear a knock on my door. And I look out the window, and I see what looks like a gaggle, a group of people all dressed in blue flak jackets with yellow FBI stenciling on the back, carrying shotguns and guns. I opened the door, and my initial thought was, you have the wrong address. What are you doing here? The person said to me, are you Sam Mangle? Yes. They grabbed me by the shirt collar, threw me up against the wall, handcuffed me, and said, you're coming with us. You're under arrest. I said, what do you mean? I've been retired for 4 years. How could I be under arrest? Surely you're trying to get the drug dealer next door. Didn't say a word. They walked inside. They went through my house. They woke up my wife. And when they realized that I was not a major, you know, drug kingpin or you know, somebody who was armed, put me in the back of a car. And on the way from where I lived in Boca Raton, Florida, up to West Palm Beach, the FBI officer said, I'm being charged with wire fraud. I said, wire fraud? Again, I've been retired for 4 years. Can't tell me anything. Appeared in front of a judge, had to get an attorney. The judge read my charges. I pled not guilty and learned what was going to be the next 2 years of my life. Eventually, I didn't contest the charges, the jurisdiction being changed from South Florida up to Philadelphia, where the charges were brought. And I learned that I was charged for wire fraud and in this case, insurance fraud, because in 2011, a year before I sold my company, I had a senior employee. I had about 150 employees working for me. And one of my senior managers was arrested in New Jersey for a drug charge. He made a deal with them and said, listen, let me tell you some things that were happening at this much larger company, and it might be of some interest to you. Right, wrong, or indifferent, I own the company. I was the CEO. The proceeds of what were being done inured to me, whether I knew it or not. And to be honest, the government didn't want to know if I knew it or not. I was charged. They threatened to bring my wife into it. So I did what I felt was appropriate. I pled guilty to the charge. 2018, I remember meeting with my attorney beforehand and saying, don't worry, you're getting probation. I have all lined up with the prosecutor. We'll go. And that morning, I dropped my daughter off at work and I said, you know, wherever you want to go for dinner, we'll go. At sentencing, the prosecutor stood up and recommended 12 months probation. Home confinement probation. My attorney looked at me and winked. And it was my turn to speak. I stood up in front of the judge. I apologized. And I just remember the judge looking down at me. And this is a particularly challenging judge in Philadelphia. And remember, federal judges are appointed for life. At the end of the day, they go home. And he said, Mr. Mangal, you are no different than any vagrant on the street. You're actually worse. Clearly, you don't accept responsibility and show no remorse for what you did. 20 minutes later, he said, and I'm going to do something I rarely do. I'm deviating from the guideline, the recommendation. I'm giving you a sentence of 60 months. And at first, I thought he said six. And I looked down at my attorney. The attorney wouldn't look at me. And he wrote 60 on a big legal pad and circled it a few times. And the only thing I think of is, wow, I'm going to be in prison 85%. That was the law, the rule at the time, for 4 years and 2 months. I turned and looked at my wife. My mother was in the back, my in-laws. And I was speechless. And then the judge went on to say, and I'm remanding you to custody now. Unheard of. White collar. You don't get remanded. You get to surrender. You get to go home. You're given 60 days. I was remanded. And they marched me into the bowels of the Philadelphia Detention Center, where I was put into a holding area with 15 other people from inner city Philadelphia. I was the only, you know, older, bald, white Jewish guy. And I was scared. They marched me upstairs to the floor I was on and gave me a bedroll, a couple, you know, towels, and said, that's your cell. Went into the cell, and there was a 30-year-old kid to me with two teardrops on his eyes. And he said, I'm here for 30 years to life for selling fentanyl or something. And that's it. I thought, that's the end of my life. I'm going to die right here. And what a lousy way to go. And it was scary. 30 minutes later, somebody came into the cell and looked at my cellmate and shook his head and said, he's okay. Somehow, miraculously, they realized I was not a child offender, a sex offender. I didn't know that in a detention center, guys had cell phones. And this kid across from me, my cellmate, said to me, you know, I never met a Jew before. And the only thing I can think of saying to him was, that's funny. I never met a gang member before. And I thought, as soon as those words came out of my mouth, if I wasn't killed when I first came in, now he's going to kill me. And he smiled and he said, we're going to get along just fine. I spent 6 weeks at the detention center in Philly. Then they called my name, pack up, you're being moved. It took me 2 weeks, called diesel therapy, shackled on a bus, to get down to the camp in Miami, where I then started the next 20 months of my life. I was sentenced to 5 years, home in about 21 and a half months. At the camp in Miami. And a couple years later, here I am.
Did that inspire you to want to be in this line of business as well? You know, going through that process and feeling the difficulty of it and what you experienced?
When I was there, I saw two or three other inmates that told me, and they told me they got 36 months, 18 months, a year and a day, that they worked with consultants. They worked with people that were able to explain to them how to present yourself to a judge, what not to do, how not to be indignant, how to own what you did. So I always tell clients now, for instance, that when you're in front of the judge and preparing for that sentencing, you have to accept responsibility. You've already pled guilty or you've already been found guilty. So it's not a time to get up and still preach your innocence. It's not a time to get up and make excuses. I always say two words never to use in front of the judge are but and because. Judge doesn't want to hear that. The judge wants to know you own what you did. You identify your victims. Hey, I hurt all these people. I took money from these people. I owe a debt to the taxpayers. Remember, if you did a crime that, you know, was insurance fraud or was Medicare fraud or tax fraud, your victim is the judge. You took from him. You took from every taxpayer. So you have to, you know, read your audience and understand who you're talking to. So when I was in Miami and I saw, wow, these guys got much better outcomes. I remember saying to my wife on a visit one day, and my daughter was there, hey, when they said, what are you going to do when you get out? I said, I want to be a consultant. I want to help people. And my daughter was livid. No, you can't. When you get out, you know, you have to put this behind you. Forget about this. And I said, no, I think I can do this because it's about being empathetic. It's about, you know, I tell people now, 85% of my job is therapy, is being a pseudo-psychologist, listening to people, listening to their families. Because ultimately, what I do is twofold. I help people try to get the best outcome at sentencing, and I'm not a lawyer, but there are ways to mitigate your sentencing. And then the other thing I do is, how can I help people, once they've been sentenced, get out as quickly as possible? How can I help someone get to a non-custodial environment, halfway house, home confinement, as quickly as possible? And that's all that anybody wants. You can dress it up like a pig, but it's still a pig. And I realized that I had the ability to do that for people. And that's really why I got into it.
So what's a day in the life kind of like being a consultant for these type of people? Like, is it very, it seems like it'd be very stressful and tense, but it could also be, you know, very calming and a sigh of relief for a lot of people too, to kind of feel like they know what to do and how to handle the situation and mentally, you know, prepare for it. So what's it like working in this space, and how do you feel on a day-to-day like doing this, working with these kinds of people?
Empathy. And in many ways, I try to lighten the burden, the stress, the fear, the unknown. Because remember, going into prison, many people's vision of prison is Oz, the series, or Orange is the New Black. And I always try, and I start off a story by, I got to camp in Miami on a Wednesday. On a Friday night, 7 o'clock, I was in bed and I just hung up the phone with my wife and I was upset. You know, I just basically wanted to crawl up and cry. I miss my family. And all of a sudden, I had a 7'2" young black fellow, tattoos everywhere, gold teeth, not a shred of fat on him, wasn't wearing a shirt, muscles, came and sat down in the bed next to me. And he smiled and I thought, my God, I'm gonna die. I must have looked at him wrong. This is what you see on television. And this is, thank God I just said goodnight and I loved my wife. And he smiled and he said, hey, Mangle, I'm going out for dinner tonight. What can I get you? I said, dinner? We just had dinner 2 hours ago. Mangle, it's a Friday night. We're at the camp. I'm going out, I'm getting ribs and chicken, Chinese, or Burger King. And I thought maybe he was kidding with me. What do you mean you're going out? But remember, in camps, many camps don't have fences or cells. So it's a, you know, you're basically community custody. If you want to leave, you can leave. You become a fugitive if you're caught. So I figured, okay, I have to play along with it. I said, all right, get me a quart of chicken fried rice. I said, but how do I pay you? And he said, don't worry. And I had a wedding band on. He said, have your wife Cash App or Venmo, whatever it was, to buy my baby mama. I didn't know what that meant. I had no idea what that term was, but I was afraid to ask him. So I asked the guy above me after he left, what is that? And he explained it. Then this fellow said to me, what can I get you to drink? I said, drink. I have a soda right here. Mangle. It's a Friday night. I'm getting beer, vodka, or Courvoisier. And when this young fellow with gold teeth said Courvoisier, the only thing I could do not to laugh was remember, hey, I could get, you know, stabbed here on the spot. Now I'm okay. 2 hours later, I see this, you know, 7-foot-tall fellow coming in, 5 pies of pizza and a bunch of clamshells of food. And he came over and he gave me my chicken fried rice and he handed me a brown paper bag. And I said, you know, what's in it? Mango, I felt bad you had nothing to drink. I got you 2 Krispy Kreme donuts. And at that point, I realized, A, I would be fine and I would make it through this. Boy, what interesting stories I'm going to have for people when I get out. And you know, I try to explain to people that it's going to be okay. You're going to get through this. The person you go in at is the person you will be there. And if you are street smart and friendly and you know, not a total jerk, you will make it through it. Now, certain clients and certain other people that I work with have challenges with that. But when you explain to their families, particularly, they'll make it through this. And if during the interim you have concerns or problems or fears, you'll call me. You know, I work 7 days a week because knowing there's someone to talk to who's been through it is the most valuable part of this experience. It, for me as well, because my wife had no one to talk to. And you can talk to your family, you can talk to clergy, but talking to someone who's been through it or a spouse has been through it really puts things in perspective. And I would say 85% of what I do is the consulting aspect of it, walking people through it and removing as much of the fear as possible and explaining, this is a hiccup in your life. You'll get through it. And whatever number the judge reads, whatever that number might be, that's just a starting point. And from there, through the different programs we might have available to us, you whittle it down. So if you have 60 months, my average client spends about 18 to 19 months in custody. And when you start putting that in perspective for families, it really does bring down the temperature.
It sounds like that'd be very helpful, especially for families that are, you know, stressed over those kinds of situations. What type of clients do you tend to work with? Is it pretty broad, or do you like to work with a specific subset?
Primarily, I work with white-collar financial offenders, professionals, doctors, lawyers, accountants, business executives. Now I'm seeing, believe it or not, more and more folks involved in crypto. But again, it's all financial type of fraud or charges. I can tell you it's easier the kind of clients I tend to stay away from. And that's the violent charges, sex offenders, things like that. I'm able to pick and choose with whom I work. And it's not that not everybody deserves representation. Everybody deserves help. So occasionally I'll get a mother of a child that might be in custody and have a sex offense. Then I might talk to the mother and help explain the environment their child is in. I usually do that more on a pro bono basis. Sometimes I help them get to a safer facility. But my area of expertise and knowledge really is in the white collar, helping business executives and their families and professionals navigate the system. It's also, and especially with foreign nationals that have a unique set of problems because they can't serve in a camp. They can only serve in a low security facility, treaty transfers and things like that. I'm able to choose with whom I work. And if I don't feel comfortable, I can always refer them to somebody else or at least give some free guidance.
One individual I want to ask you about that you've given comments for and commented on is Sam Bankman-Fried. And he's a pretty big name, obviously, because of the fact that he was the former CEO for FTX under his management and executive branch. They lost, misused, misplaced billions and billions of dollars in customer funds. And so that wound him up where he is today. And I saw some of your comments in, I believe it was Hacker Noon, in regards to Sam Bankman-Fried and, you know, what he kind of has done wrong maybe with his process and trial before he got put behind bars. Maybe some things he could have done better, as well as maybe what life's going to look like for him. So I wanted to ask you, so I wasn't sure if you had tried to reach out to him at all before to see if he wanted to consult with you, or if it was you just providing commentary on the subject at hand.
In his case, I think he's been given horrible advice. And no, I do not work with him. I think he has a unique set of challenges. I think A, the charges themselves, the fact that he went to trial and lost, the fact that he was a really bad pretrial defendant. He did things that he was absolutely told not to do. Keep in mind, the judge has the ultimate power. And if you cross the judge, as in his example, they remand you to custody. I think that up until the day of sentencing, when he expressed remorse for his victims, or at least identified his victims, I think he was very indignant. I think that he tried to fight the system. I understand the mentality of I was right, I didn't do anything wrong, or I made everybody whole. Well, I guess you can say that you made everybody whole based upon the purchase price of whatever the asset was at the time. They obviously didn't capture the appreciation. But the notion of I can explain my way out, or let me try to rationalize what I did to a jury of 12 men and women that really don't understand the charge. They don't understand crypto by any means. And in many instances, choose the path of least resistance, which tends to be guilty, which is why I think 98% of all charges the federal government gets leads into a conviction, whether through plea or at trial. He is his own worst enemy. And what I fear most for him now, because with a 25-year sentence, less the time he served, his chances are going to go to a low security facility. So you have camps, minimum security, community custody. In a low, well, there might typically, unless it's an older facility, there are no cells. They're typically open pods and things like that. But he's going to encounter things that he absolutely, in my opinion, runs a risk of running afoul. He will encounter cell phones. He will encounter iPads, access to the internet. And I'm quite sure, based upon, you know, what I know about him, he's thirsty for access to the internet. I think he also wants to tell a story. And these are all very taboo items in a federal prison. They're smuggled in, they're, you know, droned in, readily available. But he can turn what will probably be another 17 and a half years, 17 years of custody, in custody, into probably close to 24 years. Because I think he might lack the discipline to understand that when presented with this technology and opportunities to use it, he has to stay away from it. And I think because of his personality, whether he's on the spectrum or not, I don't care, he's going to not have the discipline to say no. And in prison, when you use a phone and you use an iPad, you always get caught. You might not caught physically using it. They catch the device, they pull the SIM card. And I think he's probably his own worst enemy. And it's going to be a challenge for him to navigate the system and get out as quickly as possible. He's young, he's brash, in many ways he's immature, and clearly I think he lacks discipline. And all of these traits are going to put him at risk, not physically at risk in prison, but at risk to extend his stay, because he's not going to learn to say, no, I can't, no, I shouldn't. And being in prison is when most people should learn their lesson. Because no one I know wants to go back.
In that same article, there was a line where you mentioned that, like you just said, avoiding prison is probably not the best outcome for SBF or what he should not be pursuing. Like, he should actually seek the time and make amends. Is that the best path forward for him? Is that what you meant?
A, it's the only path forward for him at this point. I think this is an ideal opportunity for him or anybody entering the Bureau of Prisons to recalibrate. This is his opportunity to go in and, you know, in prison, there's something called sentry classes where inmates teach other inmates something. When I was in Miami, the one person I got along very well with was Peter Madoff, Bernie's brother, and a couple years older than me, but he was able to teach a class, and whether it was on business law or marketing, inmates are able to teach classes. And I think he has an ideal opportunity to teach others about crypto. I think he can teach others about business and marketing, and he can use his knowledge to better himself and to create the discipline, to learn the discipline that he's going to need, because he's going to get out. He's going to get out in his high 40s. And if he doesn't learn a lesson and he doesn't learn from the opportunity to grow inside, he might get out, you know, a 50-year-old child and not have the discipline and knowledge to prevent himself from putting himself back in jeopardy again and winding up back where he is. So, you know, in my opinion, I don't think he's going to win the appeal. I think most people don't win appeals. I don't know what he's appealing on. I don't know there are any mistakes at trial. I think his sentence was within guidelines, so I can't appeal that. I think Judge Kaplan is a very fair judge in New York. So I think the notion of appealing makes a defendant feel good. It gives, it's like the last chance of getting out of the situation. I appealed. It felt great until 18 months later, I realized just another way of an attorney making more money. So, and it's a grasp at hope. I think he really needs to put his head in the mentality and mindset that he's going to be in a closed situation with 1,000 other inmates. And what can he do in that time, A, to pass the time as quickly as possible, but make the best of it and come out a better, more disciplined person.
Yeah, I think that probably would be good advice for him, because I've heard stories of how he's giving investment advice in prison and all this stuff. And I'm it makes me very curious, you know, is he going to learn a lesson? You know, does he even care about what, you know, happened? Like, he says he does, but his actions say something else. And he was facing like life plus in prison, and now he's gotten a very, very reduced sentence. And he's already trying to appeal that. I don't know in his case, but it leads into an interesting question. More broadly, what are some common mistakes that maybe you see in situations like this that could have been easily avoided, or that are preventative measures, or, you know, in the process of facing prison time that people make that they could have, you know, easily just not put themselves in a worse situation?
I don't know if he was presented a plea, and if he was presented a plea, if it was something that could have been worked with. Certainly when you accept the plea, you get everything. The Bureau of Prisons is based upon a point structure. So your charge carries certain points, the amount of money and loss carries points. If it's drugs, it's based on weight. So I think if he would have accepted and owned what he did sooner, I believe he also perjured himself on the stand. A lot of what he did was really immaturity and a lack of guidance. I'm told that his parents are challenging and might have caused some of the issues at hand. And again, I'm not intimately familiar with how his parents acted with he and his attorneys, but given the ratio of people that lose against the government, I mean, if you know that you walk into a casino and 98% of the time you will lose, are you going to walk in the casino? Are you going to gamble? The odds are stacked against you. So I think from the outset, contacting victims, contacting other people in the case, co-defendants, perjuring himself on the stand, not owning what he did, not accepting responsibility, not identifying victims until right before the judge read a number, was very foolish. And again, that might have been a lack of maturity. Some defendants feel they're omnipotent. These are things that I think he should have probably either gotten better guidance or, and again, hindsight's 20/20. If you would have listened to, I think the outcome might have been different. The other thing is, he has to be very careful, because in prison, people are going to think he's hidden money everywhere. And while he might get, you know, people will come to him for investment advice. What do you think about this coin or this coin? He has to be careful, because if he gives that advice and the person loses money on that, they're going to come to him. And you have to be very circumspect how you act in that environment, because in a low security facility, there are people that have a background of violence that finally made it from a higher level to a lower level. He's going to see all of these things and realize that he needs to be, and I don't know that he's capable of this at this point, a little fish in a big pond. And that's a mindset that he has an opportunity to learn. I don't know that he's learned that yet.
I guess time will tell with his case, for sure. There was another article on CNN that I saw you in which you were consulting with Peter Navarro, who is a pretty big individual, former director of the White House National Trade Council, who is now facing time. In a general sense, could you kind of walk through maybe some of the things that you went through maybe with him, or what that situation was kind of like, to kind of paint an idea of the circumstance, just given the fact that it was such a high profile situation?
Sure. And just to set the record straight, Peter Navarro, I drove to surrender to the camp in Miami about 3 or 4 weeks ago. So he currently is in custody serving a 4-month sentence. It's an interesting situation. It's the first time I ever saw somebody who received prison time for a misdemeanor and also has no supervised release on the back end. In Peter's situation, when somebody that high profile enters prison, and keep in mind where he's serving, I spent 20 months of my life. So I'm very familiar with the environment there. I also have 3 other clients there. So it made for a very easy transition for him, which I can touch on. Preparing him for that, he was very stoic. He understood the environment he was going to. Of course, he was absolutely nervous. And I don't care what anybody says, anybody going into prison for the first time will be nervous. I don't care who you are. It is a nerve-wracking experience. You're told to get up at 6 in the morning. You're told the lights go out at 10 at night. You're told when to eat. You're told what to wear. You have to go to work. So even if you're in a minimum security camp, it is not Camp Cupcake, like I've heard people expressing. It is camp, it is prison, and you can't leave. So once the reality sunk in as to where he was going and what he was getting himself into, and had to face, reality sunk in. We did a lot of prep work. A lot of it was because he was older, he's over 60. I was able to help him get into a certain dorm in Miami for older inmates, typically over 60. Because Miami, the demographics are a lot of young kids. Keeping in mind, the camp is the closest camp to Puerto Rico. Any charge in Puerto Rico is considered federal. So you get a lot of younger kids that wind up going to the camp in Miami. In many instances, it's a safer environment than what they left. But they can be loud and it's not the most ideal environment to spend 4 months. So I was able to get him into a unit, which is typically men over 60. We got him a great job. He's a library orderly. We had two guys, had two doctors and another political individual waiting for him. So it eased the transition for him. I'll actually be visiting him, I think, the week after next. It's prison. And no matter how you look at it, no matter how one tries to say, I can handle this and I'm ready and I'll see you on the other side, it's prison. And it's scary. And it's not anywhere that anybody wants to be. So, as a consultant, I can prepare the individual and their family for it. But ultimately, it comes down to what can one do to avoid spending one day longer there than necessary. You only get 510 minutes a month of phone time. Can't buy more phone time. You run out of phone time in 2 weeks. You're done talking to your loved ones until your phone time resets. You can email, but it's a closed loop email system. So it's not an email system that you have access to internet. It takes 90 minutes for your email to get to the recipient, subject to being reviewed. It takes 90 minutes for the recipient to answer your email. So it's a minimum 3-hour turnaround time. It's frustrating. And that's the environment that he's in now.
Do you work with the attorneys as well when they're directing their clients on what to do? Like, do you also consult and say, hey, maybe this is the best direction to go, or maybe you should take your client and maybe accept this plea or do this thing, or this would be a good outcome, or this is the reality? Or do you just mainly work with the client at hand?
95% of my work is with the client. Okay. The client is my customer. Sometimes I am retained by counsel. When I tend to work with attorneys is during the pre-sentence interview stage, which is the stage between either plea and sentencing or conviction and sentencing. It's an interview that generates a report that tells the judge everything they need to know about you. It's basically the Bible of the Bureau of Prisons. So occasionally I work with attorneys as well as my client. Where I really step up and work more with attorneys is pre-sentencing, usually right before sentencing, because I always encourage attorneys, and this is after a dialogue with my client, that there are three asks an attorney has to do if and when the judge reads a number, a sentence. Where do you want to serve? Designation. There are some camps that are better than others. If you're not a U.S. citizen, what low do you want to serve in? There are some lows that are much better for foreign national white-collar individuals than other lows. Designation. When do you want to surrender? Other than in my case and Sam Bankman-Fried's, most of my clients can self-surrender. So do you want to surrender 90 days, 60 days? Do you have family events that are coming up that you might want to attend, or doctor's appointments before surrender? And what programs are you eligible for? So an attorney has to know if a judge reads a number, Your Honor, I respectfully request my client surrender to the camp at Montgomery in 90 days for the drug and alcohol program. Working with an attorney, because that's the only time to get it on the record, and then we have to then work behind the scenes to do our best to get our clients to that facility. That's when we work with attorneys as well. Some attorneys are great to work with. Other attorneys, I kind of say they have a God complex and want to do it all their own way. Well, that's scary. And I do my best to convince the client to kind of rein their attorneys in. Because no different than the judge, at the end of the day, your attorney goes home to their family. The defendant doesn't. And attorney might have 10 clients. You're just a number to them. You only have two things in life you can never get back. And I tell every client, can't get back a loved one who passes. You can't get back one day of freedom. So it's up to you to control your destiny. Don't let anybody else manage that for you. You're the conductor of the train. You have to control it. Because at the end of the day, you're serving the time, not the judge and not the attorney.
That's wise advice. Where can people get in touch with you if they want to work with you, they want you to consult with them? Where would you direct them if they want to make initial contact and maybe set up a consultation?
So you can certainly Google me. My name's Sam Mangle. My website is sam-mangle.com. For some crazy reason, the firm I used to work with, when I left them 2 years ago, because I left them, they decided to buy my name for a domain name. So I kind of view that as an honor. You know, somebody thought that I was that valuable that they bought my name. So sam-mangle.com. I always tell people I'm available 7 days a week. And it's not that I, you know, want to brag about that, but people's fears don't really stop Friday at 5. You know, weekends, when they wake up in the morning, they saw something on television the night before, and it's a Sunday morning, it's scary. And knowing that you have somebody to talk to. And I sometimes bring my wife into it. There's nothing better than having a spouse talk to my wife. You know, again, I'm just married 35 years. My wife went through it. She can share her experience with other spouses. That also brings a really unique and valuable approach to this. And just like I did with Peter Navarro's fiance, my wife frequently talks to her. That having that approach, I think, really lends itself to bringing down the temperature and the fear factor. So you can Google me, my website. You can call me. Access. It's all about access to the people that you need access to.
Awesome. Sam, this has been an amazing episode. I've never done one quite like this and have learned a lot about this arena that you kind of work in. And it was great getting to hear your thoughts on individuals like Sam Bankman-Fried, given the notoriety that he has right now, as well as Peter Navarro, and generally, you know, what you've gone through too and how that's kind of shaped your line of work now and your experience. So thank you for sharing today and sharing with the audience. I think they'll find a lot of value in this. And if any of you out there in the audience are in need of Sam's help and assistance or know someone that is, please get in contact with us or with him directly. And Sam, again, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Likewise. We'll talk again soon.